The right song at the right time can make a world of difference. Today we're talking about needle drops, how they started, and how to do them right. This is Scott's Self-Indulgent Movie Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Scott's Self-Indulgent Movie Podcast. I am Scott, and today I am talking about needle drops. So, and for those of you who don't know, needle drops is the kind of the colloquial term for a pop song or a music cue being used in a movie. So it would be, so kind of taking it back to the age of records, when to find even just the beginning of a song or a particular point in a song, you'd have to put the needle on the right point. So that's where it starts. So that's what today's episode is. I hope you enjoy it, and away we go. There are a few things more satisfying than an excellent needle drop. The right song dropping at the right time makes a good scene great. Music and movies have always gone hand in hand. Even silent films had scores that were distributed to organ players, and even the first talkie was a musical. But there's something about a great, out-of-nowhere or on-the-nose pop song setting the tone or capturing the moment. Film geeks call these moments needle drops, and they're a potent weapon in a modern filmmaker's arsenal. They're also very easy to screw up. So when did movies start doing this, and why do certain songs work? Let's find out. First, a brief history of movie music. Before the era when songs were synonymous with movie moments, music in movies was less formal. Early films couldn't record sound, so the music was either played live or via a record. Or in some cases, the piano or organ player would simply improvise something based on what they saw on screen. The organist at the church I grew up at used to do this with classic movies every now and then. It was pretty cool. The reason for this is obvious. If you have a full narrative film without dialogue or any sound, it's very hard to capture the drama of an individual moment, let alone the ebbs and flows of an hour-plus film with visuals alone. By 1927, film had finally had its major sound breakthrough with the Al Jolson vehicle, The Jazz Singer, and the era of talkies was born. And I swear this has been the basis of at least five movies I've seen, including Singing in the Rain and The Artist. From here, film scores ran on autopilot for a little bit. The movie music from this era, minus individual songs or musicals or themes, all kind of run together. They're all big orchestral walls of sound that may or may not include equally big vocals. But by the 50s, audiences were tired of that bombastic style, and movies started to incorporate more modern elements like jazz or diegetic, i.e. music playing within the film, music. But the 60s is where things really take off. Enter soundtracks. It's hard to pinpoint exactly when movies started to incorporate pop or rock music into their films, but the late 60s is where it started to take off in a big way. Early in the decade, we start to get Bond theme, some movies piecing together some great themes. Look at The Magnificent Seven or everything Sergio Leone ever did. But that door is blown open in 1967 by rock legends Simon and Garfunkel. While its legend and quality is overblown by film historians, Mike Nichols' The Graduate was a turning point in Hollywood filmmaking. Thanks to its emphasis on youthful disenchantment, a provocative premise, a breakout performance for Dustin Hoffman, and the use of Simon and Garfunkel's music. The folk pop duo's songs were a perfect thematic and mood blend for the film, especially the use of The Sounds of Silence in the long take opening credits and bits of Mrs. Robinson in the finale. What's amazing is that this kind of happened by accident. According to Nichols, he had been using Simon and Garfunkel songs as pacing and sample songs for editing purposes, but when it came time to do the final edit, he liked it too much to change it. The studio then purchased rights for 9 of the band's songs and tagged Paul Simon to write 3 more. Apparently they were down to the wire, and Paul had only had one called Mrs. Roosevelt, and according to Simon, Nichols said, "It's Mrs. Robinson now." The rest is movie history. From there, adding popular songs to your movie was a proven way to make single moments or entire movies stick with the audience's head forever. Easy Rider soon followed, forever associating Born to be Wild with rebellious bikers, as did Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, which blended classical and contemporary song choices to match its near-wordless narrative. And I'm convinced Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head would have died in obscurity without Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. In the 70s and 80s, soundtracks really took off, and sometimes surpassed the film they were featured on in popularity. see Curtis Mayfield's Superfly, or even Prince's Purple Rain. A good soundtrack became something a director would cultivate, especially if they were making a movie for young people. John Hughes may have made millionaires out of dozens of musicians by himself. More often than not, these songs had something in common, and they were usually of the time. Most soundtracks would only pull in tracks from a few years ago, or have songs that were specifically written for the album, or to match the time period of the film. Look at the guys in Platoon listening to Motown Town hits. It lines up with the Vietnam timeline. But in the 90s is where choice needle drops became a thing. There were still plenty of big theme songs a la Men in Black, but more and more, movies were picking songs to match the moment or atmosphere regardless of time period and genre, including Goodfellas, Dazed and Confused, and Reservoir Dogs. And the practice has only increased ever since. So what makes a needle drop work? So first, how does it enhance a scene? Whatever song you choose for an individual scene, or even a recurring bit, it needs to make the scene better. So here's a few of the best ways. The first method is to match the scene. The easiest way to do this is by picking a song that matches the mood. If you're about to have a badass fight scene, you pick a jamming track that gets the audience excited about what's about to go down. It's on the nose, but I'm not opposed. And depending on the dynamics of the song, you can construct a scene around it. The What's Up Danger pairing with Miles coming to his own in Into the Spider-Verse is phenomenal because it captures the prep, the beats of calm, and then the triumph. This works especially well when you add visual flourishes in time with said music. Of course, the most extreme version of this is Baby Driver, which has gunshots on beat, so there you go. The second method is to set a location. If you need a quick way to liven up your establishing shot at a new location, a song that makes people think of that location is a solid choice. This is one of the easiest to screw up with an overused song, which we'll get to, but it's a great starting point. Method number three, a joke. If whatever's happening on screen is the opposite of sexy, but the camera and soundtrack don't match it, yeah, it can be pretty funny. Or if you need to capture how overwhelming an emotion is in a funny way. Comedies have loved to do this when characters are smitten at first sight, looking at Dreamweaver for Cassandra in Wayne's World, but it's less common now. Even if it's sincere, the point is to go for a laugh. Method number four, juxtaposition. Juxtaposition means that the song you're hearing doesn't match the action on screen, though in this case it probably has serious connotations. John Woo's Face Off has the most in-your-face use of this technique I've ever seen. The scene is a shootout between a bunch of government agents and criminals, both of whom are caught in the crossfire due to our villain trying to kill our hero. People who didn't need to die are dying in slow motion over a flurry of gunfire and sparks flying, and what's playing? A sad-as-hell cover of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. This almost shoots the moon into being a joke, but in the context of the melodramatic movie and Woo's gunplay, it works pretty well. The contrast is also a great weapon to use against the audience if the song is familiar and inspiring, and the action on screen is ripping their heart out. Admittedly, this technique was probably overplayed in the 90s and early 2000s, and might be the source of all those sad cover versions of songs you hear in movie trailers nowadays. Still, I think there's room to grow with this, and some scenes like the terrifying shootout in Boogie Nights as Sister Christian blares in the background is amazing. Method number four, genuine background noise and mood setting. This is almost a subcategory of matching a mood, but I think there's a slight difference. A lot of movies like to softball pop songs into the background of their films via a live performance, a la the glorious sax man Tim Capello jamming I Still Believe in The Lost Boys, or putting a record on in their home. It's setting the mood for the characters within the film, especially since the music is diegetic, aka the characters on screen can hear it versus just the audience. Speaking of diegetic music, method number six is performances. This is very rare, but every now and then you have a film that is based around its music, and in these cases, the performances operate as both plot and character check-ins. Brown Shoes in Sing Street, for instance, is a complete triumph where our hero plays for a school, comes into his own, defies the authorities who have been beating him down, and gets the girl. These are character moments from the character's mouth and literal instruments. So what are the pitfalls? Well, we've come up with a ton of ways to use pop songs that can make your awesome movie even better. How can you screw it up? Here's a few ways. Mistake number one, pick and overuse songs. In one of my early podcast episodes, I argued that certain songs should be retired from movie soundtracks. Not because they're bad songs, but because they become so ubiquitous and on the nose. It kills any chance of impact and usually reminds the audience of another movie that used that song in a similar way first. Location songs are some of the worst. London Calling, Sweet Home Alabama, and even I'm Shipping Up to Boston should probably be shelved for forever for this very reason. And note that Sweet Home Alabama is often used just when a character goes to the southern United States, not even Alabama. What stinks is that this is actually a great time for a director or music director to pick out a song that people don't know or forgot about for a while. I still remember Ben Stiller talking on a director's commentary for Tropic Thunder about how he was talked into picking Fortunate Son over I'd Love to Change the World by 10 Years After and regretted it. And guess what? I heard the 10 Years After track in the director's cut and fell in love with the new awesome song. Your music choices don't need to be obscure things only you know. Only so many people have the obscure vinyl collections Quentin Tarantino does, but if you're thinking it'll be hot shit to have your bad guy strut while Sympathy for the Devil plays, you've been beaten to the punch about 20 times over. There's never a single song to match the moment, and if it feels obvious, chances are it's because it's already been done. Mistake number two, song isn't right. Taika Waititi's Thor Ragnarok opens with a fight scene where Thor defeats the fire demon Surtur. It's a rousing action scene to open up our superhero movie with Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin blasting in the background. It's a great pairing. Now imagine that same scene with Kashmir. It's still Zeppelin, but it's not right, is it? Most modern directors don't have this problem, since studios are either willing to buy whatever rights they need or trust the director's choices. But every now and then you'll hear a song that feels like a triangle piece trying to fit into a square-sized hole. It's missing something. A lot of the time, it's tempo, or the lyrics and sound don't match the scene. In the imagined example, Kashmir's tempo is much slower and more deliberate than the upbeat blues rock of Immigrant Song. But other times, it feels like the movie is fulfilling a studio obligation. I've mostly noticed this is a problem with soundtracks produced for the film, but not in tandem with the film. And since the studio usually has a stake in those songs, they end up getting shoehorned into the movie with weird results. My go-to example is the presence of a Sum 41 song in Sam Raimi's first Spider-Man movie. Like, literally right before Uncle Ben is about to give the character-defining speech to our future Spider-Man, he has to cut off Sum 41. And not even a particularly fun or memorable Sum 41 song. It's less common nowadays, but if you've ever heard an obnoxious, instantly dated track in a movie you like, that's probably why, and it does nobody any favors. Mistake number three. Right song, wrong part. I feel like the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, in particular their use of music, has been solid overall, but Volume 2 had a moment that was a touch off. In the finale, Peter taps into his powers and turns the tide against Ego while The Chain by Fleetwood Mac plays in the background. It's on the nose and beautiful. It's also the wrong portion of the song. The opening guitar lick is a good place to start, but there's a powerful build that the movie flat out ignores, the bridge. The Chain's bridge, from the solo bass to then the drums and the soaring guitar and vocals, is a perfect match with this scene, and we never hear it. Instead, we hear the song's opening and first chorus. It doesn't torpedo the moment or movie by any means, but if you're going to go with a giant song that a lot of people know that also used that bridge in the trailer, you may want to capitalize on the natural drama within it. This might only be a problem for music geeks like myself, but trust me, it's hard to ignore if you know the song being used. And the final mistake, a straightforward cover. Modern movies are full of covers of old standards. The go-to method now is to slow down the track for a dramatic impact or pick up the pace. While it might seem lazy, it's not a terrible way to put a new spin on a familiar song. What drives me and a lot of audiences crazy is hearing a straightforward cover of the song that's almost an exact match for the original, minus something. My recent example is a movie whose title I'm forgetting used Joan Jett's Bad Reputation performed by somebody besides Joan Jett. While I'm sure there are ways you could update the song, playing it as Jett plays it without Jett's edgy voice sounds like a pop singer trying out a bad girl phase. This often offers unfair comparisons to the original and can distract your audience. So, what's our takeaway? With near infinite music choices, be they instrumental or pop, at a director's disposal, creating a great needle drop is much like a great song. It just needs to fit.
This has been episode 67 of Scott's Self-Indulgent Movie Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to join Scott's Self-Indulgent Movie World on Facebook for the latest reviews, discussions, and more. Stay safe, everybody. Catch you next time.